You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're taking a listen to Wisconsin's musical past. You're hearing the sound of Otto and Iva Rindlisbacher and the rest of their group, the Lumberjacks, performing a song released in 1941 in Rice Lake.
Songs like that one are the focus of a new effort to preserve the musical heritage of the Upper Midwest. UW-Madison's Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Culture and the Mills Music Library have received a $230,000 grant. It's going to go towards preserving recorded music from indigenous and working class immigrant groups.
Here to tell us more is Jim Leary, co-founder for the Center of the Study of Upper Midwest Culture and professor emeritus of folklore and Scandinavian studies at UW-Madison. He's the author of Folk Songs of Another America. Jim, welcome back.
Hey, I'm very glad to be here. Thank you, Rob.
Well, tell us the range that we're talking about when we use this phrase, our upper Midwestern musical heritage.
Well, I think you can go back to the late 18th century when all kinds of indigenous people began to interact with French folks and others involved in the fur trade, trading fiddle tunes and other kinds of rhythms, and a lot of that picked up in various other ways in the 19th century, but we don't know what any of it sounded like in a kind of a tangible auditory way until the early 20th century when people began to make recordings, some of them field recordings, some commercial recordings.
So when you think over this genre, this group here, what are some of the key musicians and music makers that you're thinking about preserving?
Well, we have all the indigenous peoples, and they have a wide variety of musical styles, from the Oneida, who've come from the east, to the Ho-Chunk, who've always been here, to the various Algonquian people like Potawatomi, Menominee, Ojibwe. And then, there's fiddle music, accordion music. There's a lot of non-Anglo-European music of Germanic, Slavic, and Scandinavian people, especially in Wisconsin, and French people, too. And a lot of that gets kind of mixed around as well or gets changed through time, interacting with forms of popular music and little local traditions on the ground.
Before we listen to some of the other music that we're going to check out today, I want to talk about this preservation effort. What's out there? What form is it in? What are you going to have to do to keep it around?
Yeah, well, the commercial record companies were interested in selling records and record players to the so-called foreign-born, and so they had a foreign series that targeted a lot of immigrant and ethnic groups, and we've got 20,000 or so of those foreign series 78s in the Mills Music Library, and we're actively acquiring others. But then folklorists and ethnomusicologists began to make field recordings as early as the 20s and especially through the 30s and 40s. And then there was a kind of a drop-off, and then Rick March retired from the Wisconsin Arts Board, and I and a number of other people began to do a lot of this field recording from the late 70s through the mid-90s. So those are all in different formats, in discs, in reel tape, in cassette, in digital audio tape or DAT. Now we're recording in digital format, but what we have to do is try to convert some of these older recordings to digital format, both to preserve them and to make them more widely accessible, because we really want to get these songs and tunes repatriated back to the communities and to the larger public in this region.
And how big an undertaking is that?
It's a massive undertaking. Yeah, it'll take a lot of work because not only do we have the sound recordings, but we have photographs, we have field notes and so forth, but the stuff is in many, many different languages, and we have tons of it. And so this three-year grant, I think, will allow us to make some pretty significant progress, but we're just going to be prioritizing because we'll be scratching the surface.
Well, given that it's an ongoing project and technology is always changing, maybe the word final isn't the right word, but what is the final form you envision for this project?
Well, we want to have a sophisticated website where you can see images of the 78 RPM record labels, where you can see the field notes, you can see photographs of some of the performers, you can hear the sound files, and in some cases, we may highlight particular recordings by providing more background about the performers and the style. We want to have some events that go on with this. We want to work some of this into K through 12 curriculum. We want to be able to invite musicians and scholars to acquaint themselves and not only with what we can put out online, but with the deeper material in the collection. So we really want to kind of help to spark a revitalization and a renewal of attention in this important cultural material.
We're talking with Jim Leary right now, co-founder of the Center of the Study of Upper Midwestern Culture, and we're talking about a new grant that's going to help fund preservation of historical musical recordings from Wisconsin and the Upper Midwest. And to get at Jim's a little bit more before we listen to music, we were talking about it, bringing more attention to this kind of music. That was a big point of your book, was that when people talked about music of the Upper Midwest, we didn't really know what we were talking about. Do you think that an effort like this could start to change that and bring it into greater focus for scholars and for just everyday people?
Well, I really hope so. My Folk Songs of Another America was reviewed in the Chicago Reader, the New York Times, and the Los Angeles Times, and they all said, wow, who knew? We knew about music in the South, but not in the Upper Midwest. Who knew that lumberjacks could be so wild, or that there were Welsh singers or all these indigenous people? So, I hope so.
Let's check out some of the music. I think this is something that you may have recorded yourself, if I understand correctly. It's a song with Slovak immigrant influences recorded in Mukwa, Wisconsin. Here's a taste of it.
Ready, Stasha.
Ready.
Ready.
Well, tell us about the music and the musicians.
Well, that was Tom Johannek on button accordion, playing his immigrant father's button accordion. They're Slovaks, and he was singing with some of his a brother and a cousin and some neighbors. I recorded this in 1981, and they've had a strong Slovak music tradition there since the early 20th century. This was a song a woman is complaining of. That the musicians didn't invite her to the dance, and she was ready to tip them, and her mother had made some kolaches, and next time, even though it's midnight, let me know, and I'll be there.
That's a fun story. Well, there's another one you brought. We've got a field recording of a hymn. This is another one from the 80s. Here's a listen.
Armon lapset kaiki tälla. Panka pois jo murhenne, ei ole syytä soron meillä.
And Jim, tell us about what we're listening to there.
Well, that's a Finnish Lestadian or Finnish Apostolic Lutheran hymn, and this is a kind of a low church movement that started up in Sápmi, in the Sami region of northern Sweden, and then spread over to the Tornio River Valley that divided Sweden from Finland. And a lot of immigrants to the UP and northern Wisconsin, some to northern Minnesota, were from this Lestadian tradition. And this was a recording I made in the Highbridge Marengo area of southern Ashland County. And at the time, in the early 80s, there was a guy named Richard Kumpala, who was a butcher at the Iron River Co-op, who was a called preacher, and he was still composing songs in Finnish. But the lead singer, Charles Carey, was their hymn singer, as they called him, their cantor. And so he knew all the tunes. They don't have any written notation, and he had a strong voice and had to kind of lead the singing, and his ex-wife, Lempi Luoma, was joining him on vocals there.
We've talked a lot about archives and these 20,000 discs you have to preserve now. Are there living traditions that you're still out there collecting, or maybe your students are out there collecting of new immigrant communities?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's always music going on. Very interesting Hmong traditions where people are composing new songs about the American experience, and the same with other immigrants who have come to this community. And then entrenched, whether indigenous or ethnic or children of immigrants, working class communities are also sustaining a lot of these older kinds of traditions of social dance music and song. So it's a very vibrant scene out there still.
Jim, thanks as always for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Jim Leary, Professor Emeritus of Folklore and Scandinavian Studies at UW-Madison. He's co-founder of the Center for the Study of Upper Midwest Culture. He talked to us about a new grant that's going to fund preservation of historic musical recordings from Wisconsin and the rest of the Upper Midwest.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin women who are employed full-time lost a combined total of more than $8.3 billion each year, in fact, due to the wage gap, according to one report. We'll find out more.
First, 5% of Americans say they've had a near-death experience. These experiences are characterized by a host of different sensations, including feelings of serenity, security, and the presence of a light, to name a few.
Our next guest explored the science behind near-death experiences after her father had one. She's here to talk about what she found. Amy Patterell is a health journalist based in California. Amy, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with your father's story that inspired this piece. What was his near-death experience like?
Well, he had a crazy car accident and basically careened into a brick wall, and the people at the scene had to extract him from the vehicle. They were shocked he was alive, and in fact, he was barely conscious or not conscious. His blood pressure was so low. And so as he described it to me the next morning, it was like this he remembered hearing voices and things, and he saw this, basically described an out-of-body experience where he felt like he saw this shadow crawling across the wall. And he just felt like he was enveloped in peace, and he couldn't explain it. It was, you know, listening to him describe it was very strange, you know, because he couldn't really explain it. But he just talked about feeling this overwhelming peace and that there was this crazy quietness, even though he had a sense of the blaring alarms and the people working on him and all of that. He was in this peaceful quiet. So that's how he described it.
And obviously he survived, but that wasn't the end of the story for him. It sounds as though what happened next was almost just as remarkable, because what happened, that near-death experience, it changed him. What happened?
Yeah, so, you know, in the months after the accident, he was going through a lot of recovery and was hospitalized for like a couple of months, actually. And but after that, you know, once he got back to sort of normal life, he was writing a lot, and he was, you know, doing things that he never used to do, like sending cards, and he would send me and my sisters flowers. And this was a guy that was a mathematician. You know, he was very numbers-oriented, very logical thinker, and he was starting to write poetry, even giving us poems on Mother's Day that were really beautifully written. So it was kind of like he tapped into this whole other side of his brain after this experience. And so, yeah, it definitely changed him. It changed our entire family, for sure.
Well, and it inspired you to try to find out what science there was behind this concept of the near-death experience. What kind of scientific explanations do people give, have they found, for the sensations, the feelings that people commonly report when they report these near-death experiences?
You know, there's a lot of controversy around this area, of course, because we're delving close to God and science and how to separate the two. And I had the opportunity to speak with a few different researchers about what scientists are actually learning. This is obviously a tricky area to study because you don't know when people are going to be close to death, especially unexpectedly. But they are looking at, you know, how the neurotransmitters change during patterns of, you know, things like transcendental meditation, when you're sort of between worlds, so to speak. And they're noticing that people have these, for lack of a better term, when the brain is starved of blood because of death or some other reason, it's still getting some sort of activity. It's kind of like the way I kind of described it is when a lizard or something gets their tail cut off and their tail still moves, even though it's not part of the lizard, you know, anymore. So it's kind of, the brain is still having these electrical signals going to it, even if it is sort of on its way toward death, if that makes sense.
And so, in terms of the way it's sort of imprinted on the brain and the person afterwards, what do we know about that, about why these experiences are so vivid for people?
Yeah, it's like when your brain is in a fight or flight response, the brain sort of preferentially encodes all of the information in that time so that should the episode occur again, you would know how to survive. You would know how to save yourself. So there is a preferential encoding that scientists have discovered as they have delved into this area. But again, they don't really understand all the nuances of it and how it works.
So the idea there, the things that your brain is experiencing on this life or death experience, this moment when you're about to die and then you don't, your brain gives a top priority to that as opposed to remembering all the details of, you know, sitting and eating a pretzel or something.
Exactly, exactly. And so then years later, you still remember. It's almost like when you have a child, you remember the birth of your child much more clearly than you might, you know, a vacation you had to camp somewhere. You know what I mean? Those really high emotion moments are preferentially encoded as well.
But I guess part of the bigger question remaining is how does the brain manage to catalog all this when, you know, ostensibly it's dying?
Yeah, and that's what science obviously hasn't been able to explain, and I don't know, you know, how much you will be able to explain, because there's an element of faith, I think, that comes in here, even for the researchers that I talked to. They can't explain it, for lack of a better term, except to say that, you know, it's a highly charged experience. So even though the electrical activity to the brain is slowing or it's theoretically being cut off, it still encodes. And, it's one of those things that I can't really explain.
Talking to Amy Patterell, a health journalist based in California, about the idea of the near-death experience and how researchers are trying to understand what people report when they survive a close brush with death and a near loss of brain function. You mentioned, Amy, that your father changed his personality in some ways, changed, or his priorities from math in some ways to poetry and feelings. Is that a common thing that people report, that they feel and act like, in some ways, different people after this experience?
Absolutely. There's actually quite a bit of research to support that portion of this whole bigger story. And Dr. Nelson has done a lot of work in this area, Dr. Kevin Nelson. So what happens is, you know, and it's to be expected, right? I mean, even people who have been threatened by cancer or who have had a tragic accident typically come back from that experience living a more full and rich life. I think with the near-death experience element added to it, what happens is people feel like they've touched something bigger than this universe or this earth or this life. And so that kind of colors the rest of their life and how they choose to lead it. Growing up, Flatliners was a favorite movie for me. And that's one of the things that they explore in that movie as well. It's sort of like when you're that close to death and you see your life might be cut off, you might choose to live it a little differently if you make it back. And so I think that happened to my dad, and I know it happens, you know, at least the research reports that it happens quite frequently. People report that they have become more tolerant of others. They've gained a greater appreciation of nature. They're more interested in the spiritual realm of things. Those are the types of things that people report.
Sounds like your father was very rational. He was a scientist, a mathematician. And we just talked about how science thinks they have some big explanation, some pieces of the puzzle about why brains and people respond to near-death experiences this way. But when you take your father's case, does he buy that explanation, or has he decided that it's changed him and maybe he believes in something different now?
You know, he definitely, I think, believes that there's more to this world. I mean, he reported saying that, you know, a voice told him he was not going to die today. And he definitely felt what he perceived as God. And I think that's a common thing that you hear people describe when they have a near-death experience, whatever their religion. They just feel this sense of peace or this world bigger than the one that they're in right now. And so I think he was not afraid. He told me he was not afraid to die. It wasn't about that, but that just this was not his time. And he came back from it just really being more appreciative of everything in this life and really soaking it up, for lack of a better term.
Seems like this has got to be hard to do science on. A, these cases are kind of rare. B, you obviously can't experiment in any sort of remotely ethical fashion with near-death experiences. How do the scientists you talk to feel about how much data they can ever really have to figure this out?
Yeah, and I think the scientists that are exploring this have accepted to a certain degree that they're not going to figure it out necessarily, and maybe they're not meant to. But Dr. Stephen Lorys, who is actually in Europe, he is one of the people that is at the forefront of really kind of trying to understand what's going on in the brain during those moments between life and death. And in fact, there's this whole lack of consensus in terms of diagnosing death, because when are you dead? Is it when your brain's dead, or is it when your heart stops beating or whatever? So what they're doing right now is just trying to catalog as many experiences as they can from people. I mean, Dr. Lorys was adamant, you know, I want to hear from anybody you know who's had a near-death experience, because he's trying to just better understand what their experience of it was and how it did change them after the fact. And, you know, they're studying the electrical patterns that people have when they recall a near-death experience and comparing that to the electrical patterns that they have when they're just recalling a real-life event, and sort of hoping that will give them some clues as well.
Amy, thanks a lot for being with us today.
No problem. Thank you.
That's Amy Patterle. She's a health journalist. She joined us to talk about her piece in next month's issue of Discover Magazine on the science and research around near-death experiences.
Coming up, we'll talk about the gender wage gap on this Equal Pay Day. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up this evening after 7, it's Latino USA. Tonight, a focus on powerful Latinas, including advice from Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network. First, today is considered Equal Pay Day. The idea is it's how much longer women would have to work to earn the same amount as men did in the previous year. Data from the National Partnership for Women and Families suggests that Wisconsin women who are employed full-time lost a combined total of more than $8.3 billion every year due to the wage gap. Laura Dresser is with us now to talk about the gender wage gap in Wisconsin and in the U.S. She is Associate Director of the Center on Wisconsin Strategy. Laura, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, put some numbers on it, if you will. How does the wage gap look here in Wisconsin?
Well, one way to measure the wage gap is to look at the earnings over the course of a year of a full-time, year-round woman compared to a man. And that ratio is 79 cents to the dollar, essentially. So for that's what gets us to April 12th, is that's how much longer women have to work, earning that 79 cents for every dollar man's earning.
And that's Wisconsin, and that sounds like the number I hear quoted for the national average.
Yeah, it's very close. You know, you'll hear things that are penny two off. Sometimes they're including different kinds of workers or whatever, but basically it'll be around that, and Wisconsin runs about at the national. Yeah.
And as I understand it, it may work out differently in different professional groups, and especially differently for minority women, larger pay gap there.
For sure. And you know, if you look at the labor market at all, that women of color earn less than white women and earn less than, substantially less than white men. So while that number is 79 cents for the dollar for white women, or for all women, for African-American women, it's 62 cents on the dollar. For Latina women, 53 cents. And for Asian women in the state, 65 cents. So especially that Latina number, half the wage for full-time work that men are earning.
Now, this conversation has been going on for years. Have we seen change over time here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think there's two kinds of change we've seen in the gender wage gap over time. One is the good news of advances of women. We've seen that, especially for women with four-year college degrees. And again, that's concentrating on white women, women like myself, with professional degrees and better. They've made real strides towards men's wages. Still behind, but closer. But for other groups of women, we've seen wage gaps stay pretty strong. The other thing that's gone on, though, that has shrunk the wage gap is men's wages have come down. And this is especially true for men without four-year college degrees. Their wages have been stagnant or declining. And so partly you see equity coming simply because of decline in men's wages, which, you know, like if we all meet at $5 an hour, that's not really the equity we're looking
for. That's not the solution people were hoping for. That's not the way people are hoping to meet that gap. Yeah. Well, let's start to get into why. Laura, why the wage gap? And I know there's a lot of components and some parts to this. Some people might look at this and say, okay, well, maybe women are working in sectors that are lower paying than men. Maybe they're in more of the service type of jobs. Is that part of the story?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly part of the story. Women are in lower wage jobs, but there's a kind of vicious circle about that. Women's wages are lower. So when men's jobs, jobs that are traditionally thought of as men's jobs, become more likely to be women, become feminized, wages fall, right, for the same work. So you can see that women are concentrated in lower paying sectors, education, early childhood, healthcare, but also in retail and fast food, just low wage occupations as well. So you see more women in the service sector, you see lower wages in the service sector. And that's part of the story, but that's not the whole story.
Well, a chicken or egg question there, I guess. Do women go into jobs that are low paying, or do jobs become low paying because they're associated with women?
Well, you know, this is, you know, it's I think it is a chicken and egg question, and no one can, you know, definitively separate it. But why women who have four-year college degrees and teach in early childhood settings where children are not in public schools are earning, you know, at most $12 or $13 an hour, while someone who is monitoring a parking structure, which has traditionally been a men's job but now is probably evenly distributed, are earning better wages. So parking attendants earn more than childcare workers. That's part of the wage gap, and I think that says something about how society values caring.
We're talking about the gender wage gap on Equal Pay Day. Laura Dresser is with us. She's Associate Director of the Center on Wisconsin Strategy. Well, let's look at a job where a man and a woman, same title, same work, same hours, and I'm guessing this varies by sector. What's the gap look like there when we're comparing apples to apples in that way?
So when you look at people in the same job, there are still situations where people doing the exact same work are not paid the exact same wage, and the only distinction you can see between them is gender. Different analyses will credit or assign that actual discrimination to a different degrees, but generally around 40% of the wage gap is unexplainable by observable things. And just because something's explainable doesn't mean it's the way it should be. But the cases where people are actually doing the same job and earning different wages, those still exist. You can still find instances of that in any labor market in this nation.
So is this overt discrimination? Is this some kind of subconscious discrimination accidentally? What are the explanations out there for that same job, same hours, same duties, different pay?
Sometimes it is the tradition. Sometimes it has to do with the negotiating or the information position of the person who has the job. So men happen to know someone or get told by a manager who happens to be a man what the going or the acceptable or the high end of the wage for negotiation is. And women don't have access to that information. So partly it's because we hide so much in negotiations over wages. And so people don't know. And men almost always end up with better inside information than women or historically have. In some instances, there are corporate policies that implicitly reward men or differentiate between men and women in certain sorts of ways. You know, you can see it from the pay of tennis players and soccer players down through the labor market, almost looking anywhere, you can see instances where men earn more than women. Partly it's an issue of transparency and information. Partly it's an issue of history inside those firms or expectations generated by the labor market itself.
So what other explanations are people talking about for this gender wage gap?
You know, another really common one is the disproportionate family burden that women tend to take. And so women are more likely to work part-time hours when their kids are young, or more likely to take on managerial positions that assume 100 hours a week of work or whatever. So I think that's often been assumed, that women work less or are less devoted to work. That presumption, or and also the reality of having kids, having a sick kid, having to deal with soccer practice or whatever, and that usually falls on women, also harms their position or balances them away from the investment in work. And so that's another place where, you know, of course, there's a reason that difference exists, but it's also true that we could set up our social presumptions differently so that men and women were equally likely to carry that burden. And we could set up a lot more social supports in terms of childcare and in terms of the sort of supports that parents, working parents, need, so that both parents could be more involved in the life of the kids. So that's another area that people regularly attribute a gap to.
Now, I know some communities, I've heard of Boston, for one, really trying to work together with companies to create awareness of the wage gap, and finding as their first step that a lot of companies think they're doing great, and then when they start to analyze the data, find out they're not. What kind of things do you think, before we get to government policy, what do you think businesses, corporations could do to figure out, first of all, what their situation is, and then try to change it?
I mean, this is the issue of, you know, pay transparency, pay equity. Some workplaces have explicit or just norms that you can't talk to other people about what you earn. But that's how wage gap, that's how discrimination thrives, right? If people can't talk to each other about what they earn, then your information coming into a situation defines your negotiating position, and probably things stay similar over time. You can't get rid of that gap if you don't see it. And many firms don't even know they have it because they don't audit or look that way. And so one thing is, yeah, that policy of being explicit, paying attention, thinking about how you're negotiating wage increases. Do you just respond if people ask, you know, then do you reward, or do you have a set of policies that reward specific outcomes and performance that can change how your wage structure looks over time?
We're talking to Laura Dresser from the Center on Wisconsin Strategy about the gender wage gap on this Equal Pay Day. We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced this gender wage gap? How did you know? How did you find out that was going on? What causes the difference, do you think, in pay between women and men, maybe doing the same job? How do you think this affects us here in Wisconsin? And what kind of solutions do you see at the individual level, the company level, government level? Call 800-642-1234 or post on our Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Laura Dresser from the Center on Wisconsin Strategy about the gender wage gap here in Wisconsin. It's Equal Pay Day. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the gender pay gap? Have you experienced it in your life, maybe at your workplace? How did you find out that the pay was working differently? And what, if anything, do you think needs to be done to close the wage gap? 79 cents on the dollar is a common number we see in Wisconsin and around the country. What would need to happen to change that here in the state, around the country? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now with Russ in Gotham. Russ, hi.
Hi, guys. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I'm not as concerned, I don't think, about the wage gap as the guest is. And you guys touched on the reason why, I guess the core reason why, that being, in general, as a business owner, there is some elevated risk in employing a female, you know, that may have children that are planned or unplanned, or have other opportunities for missed work. Not that they're not as dedicated, because most of the women I've worked with, I think, have been as dedicated as anyone. But, you know, the reality of it is, you know, things like that do happen, you know, unplanned pregnancies or unexpected pregnancies or other missed time for work. And ultimately, as a business owner, the job has to get done whether someone comes to work or does not. So,
Russ, thanks Thanks for the call. I think we get your point. I want to bring Laura in on this. So it's a risk for a business owner, a pregnancy risk, a risk of missed work in the future that seems to weigh more on women than on men, he's saying.
Yeah, and that's undoubtedly true. I think, there's a kind of legal issue about presuming a risk on folks who haven't, women who don't have kids, then, you can't just assume all women are going to have kids. But I know that this happens. And I know that, I think we all know that, women do carry the burden of the kids, physically during the time of pregnancy. But then after that, it tends to be the case that women are more likely to get called in on taking care of a kid. But of course, kids always have two parents, and it isn't natural or inherent that it isn't dads that leave work at least as much as moms do. It's just the way we've set things up. And so I don't think of it. I mean, I understand that that's the realities facing, but I think there are other ways to arrange the balance of work and family. And it's women who've always taken the hit. And then women in general, maybe those who don't even intend ever to have kids, take a presumed hit in the labor market because of something that's quite unfair.
Well, probably there are a lot of people who've had that same thought process as Russ. What's the solution? Is it something that involves changing the minds of all the employers, or is there a wider, maybe a policy change that would help tackle that way of thinking?
Well, I think if there's ever a world where everything kind of moves slowly together, this is one where it is a question of social presumptions, policy supports, public and private action that all move together and slowly, obviously we live in a very different time in terms of employers' assumptions about what women are capable of today than we lived in even two decades ago. And I hope we continue to see that advance and change. But it is policy and legal strategies and social presumptions that have to change along with it, or business strategies won't change.
Russ, thanks for that call. Talking to Laura Dresser about Equal Pay Day, the gender wage gap in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a woman in the workplace, how do you see this all playing out? How does this work in your life? Do you think you're making less than men? And you shouldn't be. Call 800-642-1234. Go next to Ron in Black River Falls. Ron, hi.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering what the guest thinks about kind of changing labor force demographics. There's a lot more women going to college right now. They outnumber men, if I'm not mistaken. They're getting more four-year degrees. Wondering if you just think kind of the slow creep of more highly educated woman workforce will close some of this gap just through natural market forces.
That's a good point. And certainly over time, especially since the early 1970s, one of the major reasons we've seen the wage gap erode or shrink is because the women in the labor market have shrunk the education gap. But the fact is also that even within every educational status, from the PhD to the professional degree to the four-year degree to the two-year degree to the high school degree, every level shows a wage gap where men's wages are higher than women's. And so education doesn't alone solve it, but it does contribute and help. And so that's it's a good point, especially over the last 20 years. And the gap, as your caller said, in some areas, women are getting more education than men, more specific professions have become much more female. And that really does make a difference.
And of course, we hear, thanks for that call, by the way, we hear about, and we've heard about for years, the idea of a glass ceiling in a number of industries where women have a hard time making it to the more lucrative parts of the field, maybe as compared to a man with the same educational level. Any changes going on there that you see?
I pay more attention to the porous floor of our labor market than the glass ceiling.
Gotcha.
So, there's certainly a lot of evidence that the boardrooms, the managerial, the executive leadership still remains a bastion of a kind of a area that white men are predominant, and women, people of color, are still exceptions. And so I assume that's the story still going on.
Go back to our callers with Stephanie in Madison. Stephanie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am a female in my late 20s. I have worked in management and corporate America, and I've also worked in family-owned businesses. And one thing that I have noticed that's made me pretty much say I will never work in a corporate setting again is the very blatant inequity that I felt while working as a manager in a corporate setting. I definitely felt like I was much more under a microscope as a female in corporate rather than a small business. And I was wondering if your guest had noticed or done any research or heard anything where there is a more blatant difference and pressure on females in a corporate setting rather than in a mom and pop setting where I feel like you're more of a person than a number.
I got you, Stephanie. So viewing women as a category, maybe in a larger organization. I don't know how you'd start to research that, Laura.
Yeah, I'm not familiar of research specifically on that topic. It's an interesting point. And I'm sure actually what tends to be true is that in structures with a lot of corporate governance, there can be systems that are more attentive to the wage gap, but then maybe they feel more scrutiny on all women in a work site. And then the smaller workplaces, probably there's a pretty big variation, but at least people can find a place where they feel like it's a good fit for themselves. And I'm glad, sounds like maybe you've found that.
Stephanie, thanks a lot for the call. Laura, briefly, as we wrap up, do you have a target date in mind where these wages will come together? And hopefully not because the men all go down to meet that lower level?
The progress has been slow. And if you just follow the trajectories that we're on, it's still more than a decade away. And I would like us to kind of expect more from this society and from men and women's relations in it and from the way that labor market rewards people. So I'm hoping for sooner than a decade. How about that?
We'll leave it there for now, Laura. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Laura Dresser. She's Associate Director for the Center on Wisconsin Strategy, also known as COWS for short. She joined us to talk about Equal Pay Day and the wage gap between men and women. You can still share your thoughts, by the way. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. Let us know how you feel about Equal Pay Day, what your experience has been in the workplace. You can always tweet us, of course, at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, New York is the next stop in the race for presidential nominations. Harry Enten from 538.com is back with us for a look at the latest news from the campaign trail. People are moving out of rural areas and into cities here in Wisconsin, according to some of the latest census data. We're going to look at that trend and ask about your experiences. And a guest says activists could overturn the U.S. Supreme Court's Citizens United decision on campaign finance if they learn lessons in political action from the National Rifle Association. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9, it's the Joy Cardine Show. Tomorrow morning after 6, if someone calls you a bird brain, you should maybe thank them. Joy's guest says birds are surprisingly intelligent creatures. She shares the story of the genius of birds. That's tomorrow morning after 6 here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next on Central Time, it's news from NPR and WPR. Then we'll talk about a new set of laws just signed by Governor Walker, expanding protections for victims of sexual assault and domestic abuse. I'm Rob Ferret with Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.